Hi, I'm Johanna Ferreira, Content Director of Pop Sugar Juntos. Juntos is all about celebrating Latinx culture, pride, our many intersectional identities, and joy. Thanks to support from Prime, there's so much to get into over at Juntos this month. From conversations with the Latinx minds behind our favorite new movies and resurrected TV shows, to thoughtful celebrity commentary and exclusive interviews with some of the biggest Latin music artists today. And it doesn't stop there. Get more of the music, movies, and shopping you love on Prime. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more of whatever you're into from streaming to shopping. And get all of our latest coverage at popsugar.com/juntos. Con amor, Johanna.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Ezra Klein Show. I am Ezra Klein, and my guest this week is Tim Wu, author of the awesome new book, The Attention Merchants. He is also the father of the term net neutrality. I don't want to bio too much on him because I talk a little bit about his biography in the beginning of the show, so you'll hear who he is, but he is genuinely one of the most interesting human beings with one of the most varied careers I have ever met, and just a really brilliant guy. In this episode, we talk a lot about his path, his time clerking on the Supreme Court, his work as a lawyer, his work as a writer. We also talk a lot about his ideas. His previous book, The Master Switch, is a favorite of mine. And I'd wanted to talk with him about monopolies and antitrust in the modern American economy, because this is something that is becoming really central to a certain part of the left. It is something that is objectively rising, at least in certain industries. And he's a really good guide for thinking about these issues in a clear way. So we talk about that. We talk about the development of advertising as a medium. We talk about the ways in which both advertising and modern sort of attention and informational platforms are making us more distracted, making it harder to think about things. Talk about his best advice, which I found really interesting. His favorite books, of course. This was a great discussion, and he's a good person to listen to. It's been a tendency with him that whatever he's thinking about now, everybody else will be talking about in 5 years. So it's worth listening to him closely. As always, thank you for listening to the show. If you are enjoying it, please share it, put it on Facebook, put it on email, on Twitter, tell a friend. That is how we grow. I'm very, very grateful for those of you who do that. Check out my other podcast, The Weeds, where Matt Iglesias, Sarah Cliff, and I talk policy. And continue to email me at EzraKleinShow@Vox.com with your feedback, your questions, your guest ideas. I listen to these. I read these emails. And a lot of the guests on this show come out of these emails. So thank you for being here. And without further ado, here's Tim. Tim Wu, man, it's good to see you. Well, I guess I'm not seeing you, but it's good to hear your voice through headphones.
Sure. Likewise.
So I've been excited about this conversation for a long time, in part because you are a bit of a mystery to me. I'm going to read off a partial list of things that I just know you have done. You were a biochemistry major in college. You went to Harvard Law School. You clerked for the Supreme Court. You won a travel writing award. You did a 10-day meditation retreat. You ran for lieutenant governor of New York. You were the father of the term net neutrality. You've written a couple books that I really love. So I guess my question is, I know you don't usually drink beer, but when you do, do you drink Dos Equis?
Well, usually I like martinis, actually, as you might know. But
so tell me a bit about this, Matt.
And lately,
I don't understand this.
You know, I guess it betrays a certain desire to experience a lot of things that I'm interested in. I mean, I guess in high school, loved science, loved politics, liked adventure. And so I just kind of went where it took me and tried not to think too hard about inconsistencies. One idea I had is if you don't care about inconsistency, you can be extremely free. I mean, that's sometimes a bad thing, but especially in your own career, if you're like not too fixated on your identity, you can do a lot more stuff.
Define inconsistency there. What do you mean if you're not fixated on inconsistency, you can be more free?
You know, if you think, well, I'm a scientist, therefore, if I do law, I better do, you know, patent law or something like that. See, it's a nice, consistent narrative. And I've done some science-related stuff. I'm just saying that, you know, some stuff I've done is completely not linear, and it just jumps around. So I guess that's the theme.
What is your skill set?
That's a good question. I think translation. So I was born to a Taiwanese father and a British mother, both of whom were immigrants and scientists. And so I've never fully 100% had membership in anything, although I've maybe completely also been a member of a lot of things, you know, Taiwanese society, North America, England, and my British relatives. I grew up in Canada, but I was born in America. I'm a scientist, sort of, but I'm also an attorney. I've dabbled in economics. I'm in academia. I've done some journalism. You know, I have all this kind of partial membership. And so if I have any added skill set, it's translating from one to another. Maybe trying to make really obvious what I think is really obvious clear. Maybe that's another thing. Other than that, I don't work that hard, so I don't have that. That's what I've got.
I don't really believe that you don't work that hard. I think people who say that are either being falsely modest when they're doing the kinds of things you're doing, or a lot of the things you do, you don't code as work because you enjoy them.
That's possible. But I don't think I'm a grinder. I haven't, maybe. In fact, sometimes I wish I had more endurance. Sometimes I get worn out, more of a sprinter. But I do try to be efficient. I mean, part of why I wrote this book was The Attention Merchants, was concern about losing the ability to focus on stuff, getting sucked into vortexes of, you know. So I think I'm pretty good at, when I need to, having absolute focus and getting things done very quickly. Whether that's hardworking or not, I'm not sure. I think Arianna Huffington said it, but she didn't invent the idea that I think sleep is my secret weapon.
It would be impressive if Arianna had invented the idea of sleep.
No, but she has publicized the idea that sleeping 8 hours a day might make you more effective. I mean, that seems kind of obvious, but she's done a good job. Well, I think a lot of high efficiency people or high productivity people think, you know, if they sleep 6 hours and they have the extra 2 hours. But, you know, for me, it depends on the work you're doing. If you're doing writing or something that takes heavy concentration, low sleep does not work well for that.
So tell me a bit about how you went from being a science major to deciding to go to law school. What was the path there?
You know, I wish it was reflective of a greater vision. I mean, I was in my early 20s. I had always thought I'd be a scientist because my parents were scientists. And I went into the lab, and I'm sorry to say that I was something of a failure. I actually broke a high-speed centrifuge. I just was bad with my hands. I'm sort of absent-minded. I threw away samples. I'd be like digging through the garbage. Once I had thought I'd contaminated the entire laboratory with radioactivity, it was so like something out of, you know, Spider-Man, the Incredible Hulk. kind of the writing was on the wall. I did a paper, sort of, like, and it was really bad. And I remember presenting it to people, and I could tell, like, oh, this is not good. So I wasn't good at that, and someone I knew was applying to law school, and I didn't know any lawyers, but I liked politics and always sort of liked policy and felt I was a little more social than some of the other scientists. So I just kind of went for it. I can't say it reflects any deep vision. It more reflects failing at one thing and trying plan B.
And what did you like about law school? How did it fit you in ways that the sciences didn't?
First of all, no lab work. The experiments didn't have to work. You just had to be able to analyze the systems and understand them. And frankly, I found it a little more like science than I'd expected. Contract law reminded me of chemistry, for example. Just like, under what conditions do you have a reaction / a contract? The federal court system reminded me a little of some of the very complex systems in the human body that are like the immune system, that have all these interacting parts. And so I found I was kind of a natural fit. It had a lot of the theory and structural analysis that science has, but not the experimental work, which I was so bad at. And so it kind of was a natural fit.
Did you early on glom on to sort of information and media law, or is that something that came later?
Oh, no. You know, gosh, if I could take back all the things in my early 20s, they're so embarrassing. So I thought it would be really cool to be an international lawyer. And I don't think I had a very good idea of what that was, other than you got to fly business class for some reason. For when I was in my early 20s, a job that let you fly business class, like that was it. You know, that was, there was nothing possibly better than that. So I actually spent my first summer, my second summer, working for a large law firm in their sort of international transactions practice. And they did fly me to Hong Kong. It was business class. I thought, this is it. I got my career figured out. But then there was the work. And the work was terrible. It wasn't that no one could do it. It was just particularly unsuited to me. It was the kind of work that sounded great. They said, oh, we're doing this project finance deal to build a giant energy plant in central China, and it's got all this involvement. But that is how it sounded. The actual work was essentially like a giant loan application, and you were doing all the paperwork, and it required skills that were really not mine, like keeping track of, you know, hundreds of little documents. And I was like, this is not going to work. And so I did like litigation. I tried that a little later. But yeah, I found that international lawyer wasn't for me. And then along came the day I met Larry Lessig, and that changed everything.
I think the follow-up question is obvious then. Tell me about the magical day you met Larry Lessig and everything changed.
Well, Larry, you know, he's a professor. He was a visiting professor at Harvard. Very charismatic. And he was like different than everyone else. He was very unstodgy. He talked in kind of wild terms. And he was crazy about this thing called cyberspace. And he said...
And what year are we in? Just situate me in time.
Oh, sorry. So we're in 1996 or 1997. And it's a winter term, a special course. And it's Larry Lessig, Law of Cyberspace. And I was like, what is this? So I took it. Every member of the class had to create a virtual identity and inhabit an online world, which then called a MUD or a MUSH, a mutually shared hallucination or something like that. And we lived in this world and it was awesome. And then he was so smart and cutting and interesting. And he like said things like, okay, what if you had a virus that went around the world and detected all the, you know, child pornographers and pedophiles out there and scanned everybody, but only caught the bad guys? How'd you feel about that? You know, and he saw everything coming. He was like, what if we had totally personalized worlds where you only saw the news you wanted to see? And what if Amazon knew what you, they didn't have Amazon yet. What if companies knew what you liked and then recommended products based on what you liked? Is that awesome? Or is that the, you know, the worst thing you could imagine? So we're debating all these questions, which now occupy us. You know, how do we know the news is going to be real or false when you have a million news sites? All these questions that are our reality, you know, Larry Lessig had them all in 1996, 97. And we were talking about them, and my mind was blown forever. And I was like, this is it. So I didn't mention this, but I'd also been a computer programmer. And so I kind of was handy with all the online worlds, and all this stuff made sense to me. And I was like, this is it. It was a big change. He really changed my life.
And are you two still close today?
Sure. I mean, I don't see him as much as... used to. He also, he delivered a topic for me to spend my life on. He one day asked me if I was interested in clerking. That's how I ended up on the Supreme Court, ultimately. And he also found me my wife. Sounds absurd, but he set me up. That sounds very old world. I should say that another of the people who he sort of adopted as a research assistant, much later, later I married Kate Judge. And he had this way, he sort of saw, oh, you know, there's something about this person, something interesting. And then he would sort of get behind them and push their careers in this extraordinary way. And so I was kind of an ordinary floundering student at Harvard Law School. I was kind of lonely there. And Larry was like, no, he didn't quite say you were the chosen one, but he was like, you have a destiny. You are going to go into this field and change it. So I kind of did.
What do you think he saw in you?
I don't know. You know, this is funny, but he said that in some ways I reminded him of Richard Posner, the famous judge. He said this once, and I found it really surprising. And I guess by that he meant that I maybe would just say what I thought, so that's not that uncommon. But maybe I kind of think some things are right there and obvious to everyone and they should be said, and maybe that's what he saw. Whatever he saw, the other professors didn't necessarily see. I mean, I had good grades and everything, but it's very easy to get lost at that school. So, yeah, that's a hard question to answer.
You've brought up twice now that one of your attributes is that you see things that you think should be obvious to people and they're not. Give me a couple examples of things over the years that are something that it hit you as, well, of course, this is the way the world is, and it's taken you some time to convince others.
Well, maybe net neutrality is a good starting point. I guess net neutrality came out of hanging out in Silicon Valley. And I was there and I was looking at the plans for what cable industry wanted to do with the internet. And, you know, it was like, oh, you know, we can control it. We'll block the sites we don't want and speed up some and slow it down. I was like, this is not going to be good. And at the time, I think people said, well, you know, maybe they'll make a better product or so on or so forth. I just felt like very clearly that that one was not going to be a great thing for the future of the internet. So there was one. Let me think of what else. Okay, so when I ran for election with Zephyr Teachout, I think both of us could see that the Cuomo governancy and the people around it were kind of corrupt. And, you know, lo and behold, half of them have been indicted now. And sometimes it's as obvious as that. It's like, looks like these guys are on the take. Now, we didn't obviously have evidence, but there was something. It was like, yeah, we kind of saw that. You know, New York politics, it sort of seems obvious a lot of people look like they're on the take. And then when, in fact, they're investigated, it turns out to be true. So I guess those are, I don't know, the best examples, but those are ones that come to mind.
What was your experience like clerking for Breyer?
It was one of the best years of my life. I love the mixture, I guess, of law and politics. So, of course, there were cases that were more routine legal cases, but there were also cases that were really close, political in a sense that they had enormous political consequences. And it was just fun, I think, to watch the court try to figure out inside that little bottle, closed off the world, where they were going to go with it. Breyer was, in those times, often trying to convince Sandra Day O'Connor of things. She was the middle of the court. And he had a way of doing that he would suggest to her and her clerks that, you know, the more adult course would be to do X, as opposed to what Scalia and Thomas were doing, which was essentially juvenile, ridiculous in some way or another, and would throw the country into turmoil. And I just like that situation. We also had a, you know, little group of clerks. It was 30 of us, played basketball every day. We had a lot of adventures. You know, we were, you know, young and single in the town of D.C. with a good job. And it was a great time of my life. I loved it.
Tell me a couple of things about the court that you learned working there that people who sit on the outside and see this institution from afar might not believe.
Let me say a few things. So the first is that it's far more grandiose and beautiful on the inside than it is on the outside. I used to think it was the difference between a palace and a playhouse, that there were rooms and libraries and basketball courts and chambers that were kind of extraordinary that nobody sees other than the justices, some clerks, and the staff. So that was one thing that people don't know. In terms of its functioning, you know, a lot has been written about the Supreme Court. I'm trying to think of what people on the outside wouldn't already know.
Do you buy it?
What's that?
I'm going to ask this question, actually, as opposed to dancing around it. I struggle with whether I buy it, whether I just buy into the Supreme Court. And I mean it in this way.
Uh-huh.
There is a discourse around the court as this deeply deliberative and unpredictable and apolitical institution where, you know, any case can have any outcome based on how good the arguments are. And then, you know, I read some of the political science around the court and I watch the things that, that I pay attention to. And I'm talking here more about the sort of big politically charged cases. And the outcomes tend to be pretty political. They, you know, these people, I see them around D.C. They exist in circles that are, you know, Antonin Scalia, the late Antonin Scalia, gave his great interview to New York Magazine where he talked about how he didn't enjoy reading the New York Times anymore. He liked to just read more conservative media. I've seen Breyer at more liberal dinner parties. And, you know, there's a part of me that just doesn't buy it, that doesn't buy the court as unpredictable and removed as the mythology holds.
Okay. So let me say that there's more than one court to begin with. So there's the court that is deciding the 60 cases a year you don't pay any attention to. They're actually really important cases. And in that, the court functions, you know, civil procedure, trademark law, patent, bankruptcy, ERISA cases, I can tell you are already being thrilled by this list. Those are cases where I think everything I just said is true. I don't think the court is political. I think there's a strong effort by, you know, 9 lawyers to try to figure out what is going to work best within this system. And I buy it for that. I think it is a good, you know, appellate court when it comes to that kind of thing. So there's this kind of part of law, which is, I don't know if it's completely objective, let's say slightly more neutral. And I think the court is everything it's supposed to be when it comes to those cases. Then you have the political cases. And the political cases, even when you work on them, they feel different. Let's say I worked on an abortion case. Partial birth abortion case. It was just immediately clear we were no longer in the realm of law. And it was, as you describe it, intrinsically political. Now, you had a few of the justices who had migrated at the time, like Justice Souter was a Republican, but had somehow migrated. But everyone knew that there were sort of two parties, and then there was a few moderates, and that was it. And I think that's the court you probably are referring to. And you know, is that unpredictable? Not that much. I'll say one thing about them maybe differently than, say, Congress. Congress, to my mind, has very little nose for the consequences of what it does. It just throws stuff out there. The court does have these moments where it feels it has institutional duties to the United States of America. I won't say that's always going to control what they do. But you look at, for example, Chief Justice Roberts in the Affordable Care Act case. He was just, in a sense, drawing on that deeper feeling of responsibility for the nation state that they occasionally have. And I think if there's any mystique in the political cases, it is there. I don't think someone like Scalia had that. I think he was willing to throw bombs. It's part of why I think Sandra Day O'Connor, for example, or other people always push to the middle, because there is this sort of, well, what's good for the country question that does come up and I think does limit the court from its most outlandish or outrageous undertakings. While there were cases that were legitimate and sort of legal cases, there were some that were politics, and there were clerks who were soldiers on both sides who were there. And I just started to believe that it was a political contest. These big cases were political contests. I mean, I sort of come to where you were of not buying it. And the people in the middle were roadkill and were getting squashed. It wasn't always true. There was some room with Sandra Day O'Connor, but the influence, I noticed, was on the far sides. And it was a take-no-prisoners game for some of these big cases, and either you won or you lost. And I think that changed me. I think I had more of the almost self-flattering position that many people have, where it's like, oh, I'll just stay in the middle and be a fair arbiter of all that comes. I didn't think of myself as political. I think at the court, I thought, well, you know, you kind of have to choose sides sometimes and decide what you believe in. The idea of, oh, I'm just sort of impartial for everything is a luxury that can't be sustained. I also found myself very repulsed by the right-wing views that I came across there. I had sort of maybe been more apolitical, but the callousness with which, for example, death penalties were treated bothered me. You know, you had Justice Thomas and his automatic vote to on every case that we should execute. And I was like, that's kind of a little thoughtless. I mean, this is someone's life. The execution case has really got to me. The whole vision that there was this guy sitting there, you know, about to be injected. And you can kind of see them. Sometimes I'd have to wake up in the middle of the night and imagine the person being executed at that moment. And that kind of had an influence. I was like, what are we doing this for? It's too crazy. And so I don't know. You can't be around that stuff and not, I think, have a political reaction unless you were completely dead. So that my apolitical side began to die a death working at the Supreme Court.
Last week, Kanye West accused one of the biggest Twitch streamers of being an industry plant. It's an idea that comes up so often on platforms like TikTok and elsewhere.
You see people who have blown up seemingly overnight, and the question is, who's behind them, right? That's what everyone wants to know. Tipping the scales and pulling the lever to make them seemingly the next it thing on the internet.
This week on Power User, is it even possible to create an industry plant on the internet? And if so, how?
Support for the Gray Area comes from Burrow. Getting the right furniture for your place can be really annoying. At this point in my life, I've probably gone through maybe 3 sets of outdoor deck furniture, and it's a pain in the ass for a different reason every single time. It doesn't look like it did in the pictures, the assembly isn't what they said it was, or it's just not as advertised for whatever reason. Thankfully, Burrow is the furniture company that wants to make it all a little easier. Last year, Burrow introduced their outdoor line, and this spring they're adding to it with their Dunes line, offering new seating, dining, and lounger options designed for luxury, comfort, and durability. Burrow furniture is easy to put together and take apart, so you can move or store it as needed. And it ships straight to your door for free. Gray Area listeners can get 15% off their first order at burrow.com/box. That's Burrow, burrow.com/box for 15% off. burrow.com/box.
What did you do after the court?
So I bid farewell. At time, law firms were starting to offer these large bonuses to anyone who would join. And I think it was hard to turn that money, but I decided it was time to go to Silicon Valley. Actually, it was hard to make the decision. And so one day I was having drinks with friends, and then having had enough drinks, I spontaneously called and accepted the job at a mid-sized startup in Silicon Valally that was selling tech equipment, and just went for it.
What did they need you for?
I worked there. Well, they just thought, well, this guy looks smart. Let's throw him into marketing. So put the legal career on hold there, and was in product marketing, did some advertising as well.
Wait, something is being lost in this story. I don't believe that you went from the Supreme Court to some mid-sized startup that sells tech equipment. What excited you about them? What was the lure? What was a company, for that matter?
They were up and coming. Their name was Riverstone Networks. They were up and coming company. They were kind of like a Cisco competitor. They were going to go public in the near future. You have to turn the dial back to 1999 and remember there was this thing called the dot-com boom. And it was seen Silicon Valley. I mean, Silicon Valley still kind of seems exciting and, you know, fantastic, and who knows what will happen. And I thought, I don't know, let's go for it. The other options were all to work at law firms. I did meet some people out there who were starting to talk about this company named Google, but the distance between me and them, I met Ann Wyszynski a few times there. We may have indeed gone on a date. And she was talking, oh, this company Google is really interesting. I guess she was on hiatus from Sergey Brin at the time. So I heard about them, but I was like, oh, that sounds like a cool thing. But, you know, I didn't know really anyone then. So I guess a smarter version of me would have gone to work for Google. But no, I went to work for this firm, which did end up being a loser, I'll tell you. It had its moment. We went public and the stock went up for a while. And it was all tremendously exciting. I guess what I really learned about that place, among others, is the number of ways you can commit accounting fraud. I didn't do it myself, but the longer I was there, the more I started to become suspicious. And I think a lot of us did. Maybe it was our accountants, Arthur Anderson, who no longer exist. You know, I overheard them saying, "What are they calling revenue around here?" Maybe it was the idea that whenever our stock was in trouble, we would call up Morgan Stanley and be like, "Hey, we need you to up the stock." And I was like, "Are we allowed to do that?" They underwrote our IPO. So I guess part of the deal was in exchange for underwriting the IPO, they would bounce the stock up every once in a while. Which seemed to me like, I seem to remember in law school, I'd read something about there's supposed to be a wall between research and you know, the taking money part. So this is why banks have put together the, you know, research arms and the arms that take in money so that they can make a deal. I mean, it seemed like that to me at the time. Like, why would they be together in the same company other than so that you can do their underwriting on the promise that they'll up your stock when the time comes? Or at least it seemed that way to me. And that's what we did now and then. I wouldn't say we did it every day. Then, you know, at the end of the quarter, there would be enormous piles of equipment and boxes to be shipped off who knows where. Maybe they're buried in the desert somewhere. So that was everybody was doing it, was the idea. I had a poker game with other people in Silicon Valley, and we'd compare notes. And it just seemed to be, you know, stuffing the channels, as they call it, seemed to be the way you did business. It actually was an eye-opening, sorry to go on this so long, but it kind of changed my thinking about the market and private industry. Because I think in law school, this was the height of the 90s, and like, government doesn't have the answers, and trust the market, and the end of era of government is over. And I worked in government, and, you know, the Supreme Court, I don't know, it was perfect, but it was relatively public-minded. I don't think, you know, the justices were on the take or anything like that. And I went to the private industry. Now, you know, this was maybe a bad sample. This was WorldCom Enron era. But these guys didn't seem to possess any particular wisdom or any special insight into their industry even. They just were all about convincing people to buy a stock, move it up, and then dump it. And I was like, wow, what is going on here? So it really changed my thinking. I actually think I changed my politics, both at the Supreme Court and in Silicon Valley, to become just much more suspicious of private actors.
It seems like in moments like this, the thing you're actually willing to do is not get trapped by your previous path. Right, which is actually something I really respect. It takes a certain kind of courage to clerk on the Supreme Court and then go to a job that doesn't use those skills, doesn't really build on that prestige, and that takes you off of what at that point probably seems like a pretty gilded path.
Maybe this is getting back to what If Larry Saw, If Anything. I like to think I am brave and courageous. I mean, I get a little nervous, but I have sometimes had the wherewithal to do things that look a little unanchored and just kind of hope it will work. And I'll say that going to Silicon Valley after being on Supreme Court was probably the strongest example. I went from this marble and bronze and oak palace. It was a joy to stroll into that building every day, into a world of office parks and cubicles and employees who were all wearing the corporate, not t-shirt, but the button down. And it was an aesthetically depressing environment. My salary was low. Supposedly we were going to make money in options. So there was a lot of money I left on the table that was challenging at the time. And, you know, Silicon Valley is not a glamorous place. I'm not saying D.C. necessarily is the most glamorous, but we had a kind of exciting life. And I mean, I was in my mid-20s. There were women in D.C. Silicon Valley, there were not. At that point, I think our company had one woman working there. She was secretary, and she left and filed for sexual harassment.
Oh, God.
So that was it. You know, and so it was this kind of very engineering, male, cheap carpets, depressing office parks. It was just astonishingly a downer. And yeah, but it was a good experience. I guess if you want to see things, I think I wanted to see it. I thought, you know, maybe eventually I'd, who knows, do what in life, but I wanted to be there and see what was this thing, Silicon Valley. What was it like? I don't like secondhand knowledge. I want to feel the fire directly and drink from the source. And that was that. And it couldn't have been more heart of tech than that.
And so then what happened? What came next?
Well, the writing was on the wall. I started reading this website called Fucked Company, which was detailing the throes of the companies dying in Silicon Valley. I mean, this was depressing. And I remember we used to joke and be like, oh, it's like the Ice Age. And I don't think we're one of the mammals. I think like it's coming and everyone's dying. Let's get out of here. The company did go public, made a small amount of money, but nothing, no great fortune. And, you know, the lawsuit started coming. I thought, I got to get out of here. So I applied to be an academic back in legal academia, trading off the idea that I, you know, knew something about Silicon Valley. And I managed to get a job. And so that that I then moved to Charlottesville, Virginia for a new chapter at the University of Virginia.
I want to merge some things that I know come, you know, sure, sort of next for you, which is you become at some point very associated with this idea of net neutrality. But you also write a book that I both really love and that I think is very relevant to this era called The Master Switch. Mm-hmm. And The Master Switch is about, and you should certainly correct the ways in which I get this wrong, but The Master Switch is about what happens when crucial communication and informational mediums and technologies are controlled by monopolists or other kinds of interested, powerful actors and used in part for their own purposes. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, sure. You know, one aspiration of that book is to say, well, what happens after the invention? You know, you've read books about the invention of the telephone, TV, and the radio and so on. Like, okay, well, then what happens and who ends up in control? Who gets their hand on the master switch? That was the goal of that book. And I thought the goal of it was really to make a little clearer to people the role that economic power plays in our communications environment, in our culture, in our lives. Something which I, again, going back to Silicon Valley, felt that people were sort of blissfully unaware of or determined to say was irrelevant. In the 90s and 2000s, they're like, oh, no, we've broken all the rules. There's never going to be a monopolist ever again or a powerful company. Everyone who gets power is going to be upended 5 years later, so you don't have to worry about anything. And I was like, I don't know if that's going to be right. Well, I released in 2010. I did a lot of the writing 2007, 2008, and I was saying, I don't know. I think the web, some of these companies, Google, Facebook, I think they're kind of a little entrenched. I think they're in a good shape and they will become more and more powerful as opposed to being, you know, knocked off the perch. And everyone said, you've got to be kidding me. You know, that's not going to happen at all. But I think we are in a period, not only in the web, but a lot of places where market power, and I'm trying to say I was right.
Well, I think in this way you clearly were right. But the part of the book that I wanted to focus in on here is the book is one of the more interesting analyses that I've read of how monopolists or near monopolists can and do act within new technologies, and particularly technologies where the boundaries of the technology and the rhythm of it are confusing and uncertain in ways it actually isn't clear at a given moment if someone is a monopolist. There's always this argument. Google clearly has a monopoly over search, but is search the right market to think of Google in, right, or is Google in competition with Facebook, in which case they're not a monopolist. There's real competition there. And one reason I wanted to focus on this with you is it's something that I am noticing happening is that questions of monopolies and the power of entrenched economic companies are becoming pretty central, particularly to a segment of the left. I've been hearing this with Robert Reich, seeing it with Elizabeth Warren. Matt Stoller wrote a big piece in The Atlantic on this recently. And I'm curious how you think of
monopolies in the economy in this era? Is this something that should be central to people's understanding? Is this something that is a little bit more of a specific problem in certain industries? How would you urge people to think about the question of monopolies right now?
Oh, I would urge them to go back to the progressive era. That means 1910s. And realize that we're in a very similar state of affairs where the level of concentrations are at historic high levels, and that's married with historically high profits. So I think the right way to think about this is to understand that, you know, we have allowed the economy to become concentrated to a degree we haven't seen since the early 20th century, and to understand the interest in doing something about it, whether you use the word monopoly or not, as very natural reaction to economic power in our times. People wonder why, for example, there hasn't been wage growth. Well, one thing you could say is, well, people aren't worth it. Or you could say, well, maybe because many of the markets are so consolidated, they don't feel any need to pay anybody anymore because there's not that many employers who are competing hard enough with higher wages. So no, I think it is the time to be concerned about this issue.
Give me a number here, just real quick. How do we measure concentration? When you say the economy's not been this concentrated since 1910, what's the measurement we're using?
Right. Well, I don't know how technical you want to go, but
extremely,
I mean,
extremely fucking technical.
Okay, so you would use the HHI. Do you know about HHI measurements?
No.
So the HHI is a measurement of market concentration. And
what does it stand for?
It stands for the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index.
Catchy.
Yeah. Look, it's a big hit in the antitrust world. So all you do is you define an industry. HHI is just a handy tool, you know, like any statistic can be useful if it's not completely perfect. You draw a line, you say, this is an industry. These are all the companies that compete in this industry or this market. And you figure out how large they are. And the way the index works, since you're interested, is you sum the squares of their market share. And that leads you at a number. And then you compare this to this index. And we have, in the antitrust world, ideas for, you know, what counts as a highly concentrated industry, what is a medium concentrated industry. And one of the things that's happened over the years is the HHI numbers in a whole bunch of areas have just gotten higher and higher and higher. And it's almost like, I don't know, like global warming. You can just look out and be like, okay, the economy is now more concentrated. What it means is just that for any given thing, let's say beer, good example. So people may not realize this, but in beer right now, domestically, there are just two companies that sell about 75% of the beer in the United States. Molson Coors and Anheuser-Busch /InBev, both owned by foreign companies. So that's an example of an industry that used to have, like, say, five or six actors and now has two. And, you know, if you look at airlines, it's kind of the same story. And so you go industry by industry, you count how many big players there are. It's not that hard. And the numbers are just different. They're just more concentrated. So if I can say one thing that's different between now and 100 years ago, 100 years ago, you tended to have one big fat trust. And this is kind of a problem for antitrust law, as I'll explain in a second. You had one trust, like the steel trust, the sugar trust, AT&T, one company controlling everything. And so we wrote the antitrust laws to deal with that problem. Today, we usually have something more like, oh, the big two, the big three, the big four, airlines, for example, Delta, American, United. They control X percent of the industry. Antitrust is less good at dealing with that situation, I'll tell you that. Visa, MasterCard, two companies, maybe American Express. And that is one of the reasons antitrust law has not been so great at controlling conduct by those kind of firms.
I feel that people's intuitions on whether a merger should go through or whether antitrust should be activated are typically connected to their sentiments about the companies that are being discussed. So
yeah.
Comcast is a company that has reasonably low consumer approval ratings, I think it's fair to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so
reasonably low consumer ratings. That's a very, it's the biggest euphemism
Comcast
I've ever
Comcast is an
people,
investor
people
in Vox
fucking
Media.
Hate them. So, oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Want to be gentle here.
Okay,
but,
sorry about that.
A minority investor in Vox Media. But
why don't you use Right. Maybe you could use, I guess that's the best example. I was thinking of T-Mobile, AT&T.
But look, people do not like Comcast. Yeah. I'm not trying to beat around the bush on it. That's precisely what I'm saying. And so, you know, when it comes up that they want to do a major merger, I think there's a lot of intuition that, hey, I not only don't like Comcast, but I also don't like the cable companies in general, right? It's not like Comcast's competitors are beloved either. And so fuck that, no merger. On the other hand, you have something like Google, which is a company that people really do like, but is also extremely, extremely powerful. And in its market is probably more powerful even than Comcast is in its market, because I think search should actually be defined as a market. But people's intuitions there is, no, Google's like they're a good company. They pay people a lot of money. They're using their profits to try to invent like driverless cars and like internet in space and all this stuff. And so I think that's a question I have for you here. How much are the arguments around monopolies and antitrust arguments about companies versus how much are they arguments about the ideal functionings of markets and the ideal size of major players in markets that should be applied irrespective of companies and how we feel about them?
You know, you have put your finger, and this is extraordinary for, you know, a somewhat outsider, on the central question that has obsessed antitrust for the last 100 years.
Oh, Tim, you flatter.
And it is essentially, it is essentially a battle between the economists and the lawyers. The economists and the lawyers who love them do believe that we should have no sense of right or wrong. It is just about economic performance. The champion of this view was Robert Bork in his famous book, The Antitrust Paradox. And his basic argument is that a lot of what looks like evil or malicious conduct, the so-called bad guys, might be very economically efficient and therefore good for the economy, so that antitrust lawyers should completely get out of the business of calling good or evil, out of the business of looking for malicious intent, trying to find the bad guy in the top hat pulling the levers behind the scenes. The opposite tradition I would associate with Louis Brandeis, who took the antitrust law as not merely an economic tool, although it was that, but a promotion of certain values that he thought were essential to the American Republic. Decentralization, a certain kind of virtue in business. I'm obsessed with Brandeis, and he was a proponent in business of the idea that business could be a profession and pursued in a virtuous way. He also thought that the whole goal of the American Republic was to inculcate virtue and good character in people. That was why we had the First Amendment and why we moved to Republican government. And so that is the question, and it kind of manifests in, like, let's say a merger like AT&T with Time Warner. How do you decide that kind of thing? Is it just about the raw numbers and whether prices might go up on the margins for customers? Or is there a deeper concern, A, as to whether you think this company is predatory, bent on domination, a sort of Standard Oil of its time, run by a ruthless monopolist who has no interest in the lives of his employees or the public at large? Or are you concerned about the evil tactics that might be involved? Those are the questions that consume antitrust right now. I would have to say that on the law, in the doctrine, Bork has won. You know, if you were to hang out at a FTC meeting or Justice Department, I also work there, by the way, at the FTC, merger review meeting, you wouldn't have a lot of people saying, oh, this is an evil company, they need to be stopped. You'd have the presentation of a lot of numbers and arguments about potential effects of the merger. But that being said, I think that the track record, when you get down to it, you know, it's the lawyers who finally make the call. And I think they have intuitions that shade their views. There is a reason that maybe Google has gotten a pass, as you suggest, and a reason that Comcast and AT&T, widely seen as let's just say, companies that people are not fond of have had the egg thrown in their face. That's a kind of a lengthy answer, but again, you have put your finger on the central dilemma in antitrust.
But what do you think?
Oh, what do I think?
And in part, the reason I'm asking this is that part of my job is that I try to track sort of emergent arguments in politics. And this is an emergent argument in a very big way, and one that I don't fully feel like I understand the contours of. And so when you think about this, when you say, yes, I think people should be very concerned about this as a central part of their politics, as a part of their political identity, as a part of their search for justice, are you saying that the central demand of this movement should be that in a just completely rules-based way, no market can have three players who account for more than, I'm just making numbers up, obviously, 65% of the economic activity in that market? And when that happens, there's like something triggers. Like, I remember there being a lot of anger about Walmart. Now Walmart is obviously under real threat from Amazon. But part of the reason liberals are more willing to think about antitrust issues with Walmart was because they don't like Walmart. They think that Walmart in some ways is bad. When you say this should be an important part of people's politics, which one of those theories are you saying should be theirs?
Okay. So it won't surprise you to think that I am on the side of Brandeis and I don't agree with Robert Bork. And let me explain it, though. I mean, my views are nuanced in this area. I don't believe in something like you suggested, you have a flat rule that, you know, an industry reaches 65% concentration automatically is broken up. Although I should tell you that that was a bill in Congress and that there was a series of economists in the 50s who believe that you should have automatic tripwires that immediately at the moment, let's say three firms hit 70%, they would automatically be broken up. The deconcentration, it was called no-fault deconcentration, if you're interested in it. And they just thought that was the answer. But I think that is a fairly crude device. But listen, what I think is that antitrust and private power have such an effect on our day-to-day lives. It's a matter too important to be left to the economists and left to the raw numbers, that the influence on who we are as a people and what we are as a country of the concentration of companies, especially in sensitive sectors like the media, is too much to just think that we can run some math and get the right answers, because it has such a effect on how we live our day-to-day life. The founders were concerned about concentrated power in all aspects. They didn't have concentrated private power. So I think you have to have an eye on that exact question. And I think the character of the firm does matter when it comes to something like monopoly enforcement. So one of the questions when you go into a big monopoly case and you're thinking about breaking up a company, I do think, I'll say for the record, we should do more breakups, that they have sometimes incredibly salutary effects. I mean, the company doesn't like it, but we're not talking about a person. Look, we should never forget, we're not talking about a person here. We're not dismembering an individual. That would be immoral. You know, we're dismembering, let's say, the AT&T Corporation. People forget, but some of these dismemberments led to some of the most incredible economic growth and innovation in the history of the United States, whether it's AT&T, whether it's Standard Oil, whether it's the Alcoa Aluminum Company. There were moments where big breakups had really important consequences for this country. So I don't think we should be afraid to pull the trigger on the breakup. But when you're trying to figure out whether to do it or not, you have to have a mixture of economic and, I don't want to say political, but I want to say at least moral or virtue-driven sense of whether this, what this company is doing for us, a political sense, really, of what this company is making us into as a country.
Support for the Gray Area comes from Greenlight. If you're a parent of teenagers, you might be starting conversations about money management and financial literacy. So often, the best way to learn is to do. But when it comes to money, there can be real consequences to learning the hard way. That's where Greenlight comes in. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on their spending and saving. And kids and teens can build money confidence and lifelong financial skills. My kid is way too young to talk money with, thank God. but I have a colleague here at Vox that uses Greenlight with his boys, and he loves it. If you want to help your kids learn about money, consider Greenlight. It's a convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and for families to navigate this stuff together. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/grayarea. That's greenlight.com/grayarea to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/grayarea.
Eurovision is here. This year's contest gets underway this week in Malmö, Sweden, but this year's contest comes with a dose of controversy. I'll give you one guess as to what people are mad about. Yes, correct. It's that.
Organizers of the Eurovision Song Contest say they are assessing whether Israel's entry breaks the rules on political neutrality.
I think it's a shame. I think there's no way that Israel should be able to participate in Europe.
Pro-Palestinian protesters are taking to the Swedish streets. More than 1,000 Swedish artists, including Robin, have called for an Israel ban. Some European politicians are joining them. Charlie Harding from Switched On Pop joins us this week on Today Explained to help us figure out if Europe can sing its way out of this situation.
What are some companies, when you say that we should be more open to breakups, what are some companies that you think that if we broke them up, we would have more innovation, more competition, more growth?
You know, you might be surprised. I'll give you my criteria. What you need to look for is a monopolist that has been in charge of an industry for a very long time with, you know, no signs of competition. So essentially, we're talking about stagnant industries. I'm less excited about breaking up a company that's on the growth, that's still just got there. They're doing things. You know, Google, when we investigated them in 2010, 2011, they were, you know, still on the make. It wasn't clear what they were going to do, innovating wildly. I think it's someone who's been there for a very long time. You know, at this point, for example, although they've kind of become more benign, you think about Microsoft and the monopoly it's had for so long over operating systems and Office. They should have broken them up in 2000. It would have been better, frankly, for the company. And it's a little late now to come back and break them up, but that maybe is something you could do. I think the airline industry, we might consider retroactively breaking up parts of it. We allowed that to happen. You know, let's say American Airlines and U.S. Airways, and the effects have been so pernicious for customers. The profits are through the roof, that it was clearly an error. So occasionally I think we should be willing to look back and be like, well, we blew that. It's gotten worse for everybody. Except for, you know, they have more profit, except for their shareholders. So maybe that's one to look back at. There's been a long story of hospital mergers. They're not famous hospitals, where the price of care after the merger goes up and the amount of the mortality rates also go up. So more people die and they cost more. And those mergers are just like, were a mistake. And I think some of the hospitals, when you have one dominant hospital in a city, should be broken up. So I don't know. I mean, that's a pretty big agenda of breakups, but I think we should not be afraid to use that power when it's called for.
Let me ask a question about the tripwire approach versus the more nuanced impressionistic judgment on the company's approach. My concern about that is twofold. I tend in general in politics and policy, because I don't have that much faith in the system, to be a fan of sort of dumb rules, in part because I think that it just creates clarity. And I genuinely don't know enough about this area to know that we should do that here. But the reason I ask about it is twofold. One is that, first, it feels like this is a bit of an invitation for a kind of crony capitalism. If what you're saying is that these decisions are made based on the sentiments, particularly of the political class in practice, towards these companies, well, then that really is a great reason for the biggest companies to invest dramatically in lobbying. I don't want to suggest, I have not thought about breaking Google up and I'm not advocating it, but they've become one of the biggest, if not the biggest lobbyist in Washington, lobbying company in Washington. Very, very, very good at it. If large companies knew that losing the faith of regulators and members of Congress and members of the administration could impose them to more antitrust scrutiny in an era when we were doing more antitrust scrutiny. That seems like a somewhat dangerous mixture for a pretty cronyistic form of capitalism. The other side of it, I think you see it with Trump. He does seem very interested in using antitrust, but not because he seems to have real concerns about competition in industries. He wants to maybe break up Amazon because he's mad at the Washington Post. He, you know, there's a sort of antitrust as a method of punishment and as a method of hurting your enemies that is a little bit scary here. And I think both of these are in some ways the same thing, that if companies have this much to fear from the government, large companies have this much to fear from the government, both from the government, from members of the government just not liking them for non-personal reasons, and from members of the government not liking them for personal reasons, right? Because too many of their employees, say, support the other candidate or whatever it might be. I could really imagine that taking us further down the path towards a kind of crony capitalism where in order to survive and in order to prosper, it is an existential need for these companies to invest very, very heavily in winning over Washington and also doing in some ways Washington's bidding. And I worry that would have a negative effect.
Yeah, I mean, and frankly, so those are some of the arguments that Bork made. And I...
Well, I've always thought of myself, as you know, Tim, as a Borkian.
Although Justice Stevens made it a different way. I'll repeat some of the argument. He had this phrase, Justice Stevens once said, you know, antitrust is a little bit like the law of the West. Sometimes sheriff feels he should go out and pistol whip a few bad guys. That's what he said. That's how he said antitrust. I know, he had this great line about it. So I also share with you a belief in the rule of law. Let's just put it that way. I mean, what you're describing is the rule of law as opposed to the rule of political whims and enemies lists. And I guess the question is how far you're erring, right? So I guess what I'm not trying to say is that politicians should sit around and be like, oh, you know, my phone bill was pretty outrageous last week. Let's go break up AT&T or something. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just suggesting the balance has gone too far into a purely economic driven, what are the numbers kind of story, as opposed to a broader consideration of all factors. I'm certainly by no means advocating a completely discretion driven law of, man, I hate my enemies, I'm going to break up that company because it's owned by some dude I hate, a kind of law, because that is no law at all. All I'm saying is we have gone too far towards it all just being the numbers. And even the tripwire approach that you suggest, which would automatically, let's say, break up firms and they hit some percentages, is completely insensitive to, you know, whether that would be good. So all I'm trying to say is it does require judgment calls, and we shouldn't pretend you're not making judgment calls here. But I'm not saying they should be made on the basis of animus or I hate Walmart or something. I mean, one of the reasons to give the antitrust enforcers credit that they haven't gone after Amazon is, even though everyone says, Amazon's so big and they're dominating everything, antitrust attorneys look at it and say, well, they have lowered prices. And the goal of the antitrust law is lowering prices. And so how can we, with a straight face, break them up if they have accomplished the main goal of this law, or one of the main goals of this law, which is to keep prices low for customers? To put it down, I'm thinking it calls for judgment. And I hear what you're saying. I mean, at some point in any system of government, there's no replacement for having some faith in the judgment of the people involved. And I don't think you can entirely walk away from that.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. I agree. This is, I think, a good point to move on to your new book, which is very, very close to my heart. And we actually talked about it, I think, before you had actually begun writing it.
And I give you some credit. In fact, I want to give you some credit for steering me in this direction. I remember I discussed two books, and you said you should write the one about attention and advertising. You never know what might come out of that. And so I ignored that for a while and then thought about the other book, pitched it. My agent said, oh, I don't know if that book works that well. So then I ended up writing this book. And so there you go.
Well, you're welcome. And
thank you.
The thing that I'm so fascinated by in this book, and I really, really enjoyed it, in Attention Merchants. A couple of years ago, and actually I think this partially came out of reading The Master Switch, I began thinking about how all of our informational commons have been, virtually all, with the actual exception of books, have been structured on the business side to run off of advertising. And this is true for magazines, it's true for newspapers, it's true for Google, it's true for Facebook, it's true for television, it's true for radio, virtually all of the ways in which we absorb information. Again, books being really the one major exception. And now maybe
the other major exception is film.
Yeah, I was thinking here about news information, but you're totally right.
Right. Okay,
that.
News. Yeah, you're right. Uh-huh.
And it made me wonder, what would all of this look like if it hadn't had to have as a core component of it, this is a good vehicle and vessel for advertisements?
Yeah.
I think we always think of this stuff as sort of the news and the information first and the advertisement second. But given that it literally couldn't survive without the advertisements, it's all ended up in a form that had to be useful and viable for advertisers. And so I guess my big question for you, having done this book, is what do you think we've lost that we would have had if a different business model had dominated? Or do you think it was even possible for a different business model to dominate?
It's very interesting to wonder what the world looks like, as you said, as a thought experiment, if this business model, selling eyeballs, the attention merchants, hadn't been developed in the 1830s and never took off. So in the book, there's this one guy in the tabloid New York Press in the 1830s, founder of the New York Sun, Benjamin Day, who has this idea. So, and he makes it work. And because he makes it work, it goes from this, he said, very obscure part of the economy, tabloid news, to sort of more mainstream news, to support radio, to support television, and we're talking about news here, to ultimately support almost all the main web models, maybe Wikipedia being the exception. So, and that's our reality. So the business model encourages or calls for enormous parts of the population to be paying attention to the same thing at the same time, and therefore there being something that we call a public with public opinion. You know, this idea that more or less everyone in the country is following a story, maybe it's like the O.J. Simpson trial, maybe it's the ongoing drama of the Trump reality show / presidency, whether it's, you know, earlier phases, the struggle of FDR to deal with the Depression, just all of us watching this story together is, I believe, something that this business model does a lot to create. This idea of a mass media, of public opinion at all, has a lot to do with this business model. And the reason that is what you see if you're only on a paid business model, and there's a lot of attractive things about this, as we'll see as well, but you have to deliver information that is of very strong relevance to people in a very obvious way. So the newspapers before advertising had financial news, they're sort of like Bloomberg, or they have very relevant political news for people who it's going to matter to. They're more like newsletters. And we were talking about news and not entertainment, but the entertainment products are, I guess, more produced, they're more like films, as opposed to what you can get away with an advertising-supported medium, but also where you have to aim, which is to a much broader audience. So I think you have a much more nichified world without the rise of the attention merchants. And in some ways, we've gone back to those niches, oddly enough, in our current time. But I think that's the big story, if that makes any sense.
I think that's fascinating, and it does make sense to me. Although, as you say, as this has all become more competitive, we have become much more fractured.
Right.
So that period you're talking about, that period of mass media, I think people tend to think of as sort of a 20th century thing. And it might have been a little bit before that too, but that has really been in erosion for a long time. And it's not something I see people pushing against. It's not something I see. I do see advertisers. I mean, we experience this all the time at Vox, who are trying to attain scale, who are trying to get, as you say, enough people to focus in on one
campaign, but it hasn't seemed that what they, I guess maybe what I would say here is that it hasn't seemed to me that what they need for that is for everybody to be following the same story, but to be in the same places. It's why the platforms like Google and particularly for this kind of thing, I think Facebook have become so valuable, because it doesn't matter what people are looking at. They're looking at it on Google and Facebook. Where at another point, if everybody's interested in something different, they might all be in a different place.
Yes, there is accomplished by Google and Facebook the almost miraculous idea of put in a different era. If you imagine, you know, in the 1950s, the name of the game, if you're ABC, NBC, and CBS, is winning that primetime battle, attracting 70 million people to I Love Lucy, as opposed to, I don't know what its competitor was, Gunsmoke. Actually, it wasn't Gunsmoke. That was another CBS show. But like whatever the loser was against I Love Lucy, that was the name of the game. The real genius of Google and Facebook as advertising models is it's as if they put an ad on the TV itself, or maybe in Google's case, the remote control. It doesn't really matter what you're watching as long as you're using it to watch it. On Facebook, you're mostly watching yourself or your sort of friends and family. And, you know, they've put an ad on the mirror or on the remote control. So it doesn't matter what the content is. And that allows there to be splintered content, but still a mass audience. And there's something kind of genius about that. Can I back up and say something else on my on the earlier question? I wanted to say that I think if you really get interested in this question of what the media is like, there's a really big difference between ad-supported and paid media. And the big difference is the need for scale or not. Paid products, no matter what you're talking about, shoes or media, they just have to make enough money to cover their costs. So there's more potential for reaching a niche and making money that way. If you think about Netflix right now, their shows don't have to be big hits. They just have to keep enough people subscribing or paying the monthly fee to make it worth it. The classic ad-based models really work best at massive scale, like TV in the 50s, where you are ideally getting 100 million viewers or so. And that pretty profoundly affects the content you're going for. So I think those are the tendency of those media. They can go in other directions, but those are certainly the natural tendencies of those type of media.
One of the things I think is fascinating about this argument is the way in which attention is somewhat different than sentiment. That what you need for this kind of business model, and it's not always a business model. I mean, you actually bring up the idea that religion was the original attention merchant. You have an interesting section on Hitler in here, just talking about the way in which he was able to use technology to achieve attention. And I think something that is a little tricky here is that people, what you need from them is to keep watching or to keep right. paying attention. They don't actually need to be happy about it. They just need to be addicted to it. And yeah. one of the things that seems to me to be occurring right now in different platforms is that a lot of things are using addiction more than they are using and habit more than they are using sentiment. I open Twitter a couple times a day.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I don't feel good about myself. I don't leave feeling better. But what they have managed to key into with me is something different than I tune in because I like it. It's I tune in because I feel that I'm going to miss something if I don't. In a very different way, I think Donald Trump was a genuine genius at understanding that it was less important if people liked what they were hearing from him than they were always hearing from him, right? And he yes. had this kind of like reality stars, I'm not here to make friends approach to particularly the primary, which really worked to squeeze out what other people were willing to do. So the Donald Trump brand reached as many folks and was able to get, even if it turned off a lot of people, it was able to get its own critical mass. And that mm-hmm. feels to me to be a transition we're in right now, that I think we used to think that the way to get attention was to create things people liked. And I think mm-hmm. now we're seeing that a way to get attention is to create things people are addicted to, that are very habit-forming, or to just that they can't escape, so that they are caught up in it, whether or not they want to be.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I'd be even more precise. Something that generates a strong emotional reaction, no matter what the reaction. whether it's repulsion, whether it's excitement, fear, hatred, anger, whatever it is, that is what you go for. And once having generated that outrage, hope, design a system to that makes people come back, because people come back for emotional hits. You know, there's a reason horror movies are popular. And I think you're right that every advertising medium, everyone who's in the contest for attention, who is winning, is all about the game of the neuroscience of emotional hits. And frankly, adding to it, they don't even have to be consistent. It doesn't always have to be a hit. It just there has to be the possibility. Things can be even more addictive when the hits are unpredictable. This is the lesson from gambling casinos or frankly, sports like fishing, but also of some of the science, is that you can be trained kind of like a pigeon to want the hits more when their reward schedule is inconsistent. So the big thing, and you've grasped this from the book, is that often what we think of as a contest, you know, like between two businesses or between two candidates, is there is a prior contest for getting attention at all. And the ways of winning that contest are not ones we always recognize, but are, as you say, things like just being attention gaining and somehow by all means necessary. I mean, this has been known for some time. The whole there is no such thing as bad publicity idea is this, that you just have to win that prior fight for attention. I can say one last thing prompted by what you said. If you want to understand the history of attention harvesting and capture, it is, as you suggested, the history of our habits and rituals. Twitter being a good example. The origin of this idea of needing to check in to things, whether Facebook, Twitter, you know, what just coming back is a big thing. The invention of prime time, the idea that you watch TV or listen to the radio every day at night, is a massive event in the history of attention capture. And just to finish on Hitler, so Hitler didn't really have addictive content. Well, he was a very powerful speaker, but because he didn't have, you know, couldn't guarantee that everyone just wanted to tune in to listen to him, he forced people by law to sort of attend Nazi primetime. They would round people up, this sort of group of radio wardens would round people into rooms, force them to listen to him. And I guess after a while, they would start doing it voluntarily. So even Hitler understood the necessity of getting and reaching your audience consistently, you know, every week or so.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way to put it. One of the fascinating parts of your book is a way in which techniques created and tested out by attention merchants moved over to other spaces and other kinds of practices. And I think my favorite anecdote is you have this story about Marshall McLuhan going to meet with Timothy Leary and trying to help Timothy Leary come up with an advertising jingle for acid. And he says, lysergic acid hits the spot, 40 billion neurons, that's a lot. And there's something so ridiculous about it, but also I think a little bit profound, that what the work of the attention merchant is trying to understand how people's brains really work, how they absorb information, how they remember information, how they change sentiment about things. And those skills are very transferable. I mean, something that's been happening within my industry for the last couple of years, and it's a big part of how Vox Media runs its business, is that, you know, it used to be that what a news publication was basically selling was a monopoly on its audience's attention. You were the LA Times, and you were the only major paper in that area, or you were the Baltimore Sun, and you know, if you wanted to advertise to people in Baltimore, you put an ad in the Baltimore Sun. And now, because digitally it's so competitive and the audience isn't in any one place, or at least any one publication, you know, what we're really selling is our skill as attention merchants, right? We have Vox Creative, and you can go to Vox Creative and they will make ads for you based on what we have learned at Vox.com, at The Verge, at Eater, at Racked, etc. So in some ways, I feel like it's become more of that business. And that's a pretty different business, actually, right? Selling your skill as an attention merchant versus selling the audience that you have developed as an attention merchant. And it's not that we don't do a bit of both, but the weight of it is shifting. Is a change that I'm not sure people have quite grokked yet.
Yes, it's a very perceptive change. I You know, the great example of that was BuzzFeed's move to what's sometimes called native advertising.
Yeah,
I don't think
I'm
people have
about here
got
too,
that.
I should say.
Yeah, where BuzzFeed was like, oh, yeah, we've got 10 things you didn't know about the Toyota Prius or something like that. You know, like that. Well, we have learned these skills. We know the art and science of getting people to click on stuff. So come to us. We are all, in that sense, you know, also you're better than your ad agency. I don't think people have grok that. I don't know if media organizations themselves fully accept that that's what they're doing, but it's certainly a massive transition in what it means to be the news media or even just a content creator. Business models are changing in this area. I mean, I guess I wrote this book because there is a sense that the old models feel increasingly desperate, that other things are happening. And even advertising itself might not exist in anything like what we know it now, 5 or 10 years from now. I mean, I think it'll always be something, but it could just become part of what you've just said is, you know, there are people become experts at knowing what engages. And part of it can become it's just the story of anything that can influence you in your decisional matters. And that's what we used to call advertising.
The other theme of this book, which feels to me, it's funny because I when I read this book, I sort of read it as having, you know, Tim Wu, scholar of media, and then Tim Wu, human being. And I actually felt in some ways the threads were different, and that the threat of Tim Wu, human being, seemed to be a real concern, that the way that advertising merchants and also the underlying platforms had over time become so good at this, so competitive, so something, that it was causing real changes in humans, and that our ability to focus on things is diminishing, that our ability to tune out certain kinds of stimuli is diminishing. This is something that I very much feel. I find it's harder for me to sit down and read a book because I have this tendency to distract myself all the time. And what modern attention merchants have done is make it extraordinarily easy for me to distract myself just for a second. But as you write in the book, when you do that little just for a second distraction, it's never just for a second. It's 25 minutes. It's 35 minutes.
Right.
And I'm curious how you came out of the book thinking about this. Are you more optimistic about it, less optimistic?
Less optimistic. I think more aware of just how much it feels like we live in a kind of a casino, an environment structured to try to pull you away from stuff. Now, you know, pull you away from what you want to be doing to something else. Yeah, I think it's extraordinarily hard to stay on task, so to speak, right now. And I guess that concerns me for a number of reasons, most of which I guess I believe in something called autonomy and, you know, the chosen life and, you know, some kind of ideal where you make your own decisions that really feel like yours and that's how you become who you become. And maybe part of it is I just like getting stuff done. I like the sense of, you know, spending an hour and having some byproduct at the end of it. And losing those abilities, especially with technologies that are supposed to make us more productive, you know, with better tools, them becoming a dulling of our ability to get things done or even just develop who we want to be as people. That really matters a lot to me as well. I think when, you know, you choose to read a book because you love the author and you deeply engage with it for an hour, that kind of develops you as a person more than when you randomly spend an hour clicking on stuff and you don't really even know why you've done it. You're just responding almost like a reptile to a stimuli. That to me is a diminution of what it is to be human.
Have you set up your life any differently over the course of the last couple of years while you've been thinking about this to try to cut those impulses and rebuild those faculties?
Well, I had to get this book written. I had to disable my computer, I feel like, to get the bulk of it out there, use word processors that are only the page, find ways to disable the internet for long periods of time. Now, since the beginnings of this book, I've had two children, and they've had two daughters, and they have had their own effect. Perversely, they have in some ways made me, seems crazy, but like more productive in the sense that I've am forced, first of all, when I'm them, to be completely in human time and not sort of halfway trying to get things done. But also, because of the structure they've imposed on life, on my life, I find that, you know, where I do have hours, I am more apt to do what I wanted to do. I mean, I'm not completely a control freak. I don't believe that there's not some room for wandering and just kind of seeing what happens. But I do like that idea of, you know, a few hours in the afternoon and you feel like, oh, I'm going to work on my book. I like it when that happens, put it that way. And I think having the constant, I think being a father in some ways has helped me, and that's restructured my life. I also, just out of sensitivity to these issues, try to somehow be in nature every week and try and at least spend one day a week completely off my computer, ideally 2 days a week. And I think when I keep to those patterns, it's a little bit like when you have a exercise schedule and you notice that you feel better when you keep to it. I've noticed when I keep to this kind of attentional hygiene that my life just seems to work better than when I lose it. So yeah, I can recommend it. How's that?
I think that's a good recommendation. This is probably a good place to wind down. I'm going to ask you two questions we try to ask us here at the end. One is, what is the best piece of advice you have received?
Ever.
Ever. Or at least the one you feel that you want to share right now.
Yeah, sure. The thing that comes to mind right now is the idea that everything you should do should be an end in itself, even if it's also a means. Because even if it turns out, to be a failure, if it doesn't do what you want, if it was an end in itself, you did it for its own reasons, then that has its own sense of satisfaction. I guess it's a little bit, for some reason I'm pulling that out of, and this is a religious source, I'm sort of pulling that out of the New Testament and the Gospel of Matthew as a source of that advice, the idea of storing your treasures in heaven as opposed to on the earth. And I guess the advice of trying to invest in things that in some ways are indestructible is the best advice I think I've ever received. And you get it from a lot of different spiritual traditions or just people giving it to you. But that idea of looking to store your treasures in that which cannot actually be taken from you is the best advice I can think of right now.
So I feel like there are two ways of understanding that kind of advice. And one of them I'm a little bit allergic to. So I'd love to ask you about it. So when I was a writer and like my only job was putting pieces of writing out on the internet, I really feel like I would have vibed that. Because, you know, I loved the process. I loved reporting. I loved writing. I loved, you know, having the conversation afterwards. Even the parts I didn't like, I loved. You know, I was often tired or felt overworked, but I never felt a lack of satisfaction in the means. You know, now I'm trying to do this other thing, which is build Vox into an institution that is hopefully essential to people. And as part of that, I do a lot more things I don't like. There are more things bricked out on my day. And I'm actually lucky to have a fair amount of control. You know, there are a lot of folks who do things they don't like, not because they're building something that ultimately gives them great satisfaction, but because that's what they have to do to feed their family or to survive. So I feel like there's one version of that advice, which is based around really being able to structure a life you like. And then I feel like there's a sort of mindfulness version of that advice, which is about being present in the moment and when you're washing dishes, trying to enjoy the feeling of the soapy water on your hands and so forth. And I'm curious how you distinguish those two, because on the one hand, I agree with that advice. On the other hand, it doesn't always feel possible.
So I think I'm saying something slightly different than what you're saying, which isn't just like, oh, make sure you only do stuff that you enjoy, because I think that's not what I'm saying. I, for example, like mountain climbing, and I was thinking the other day that most of mountain climbing is
like
really,
climbing.
Really, yeah, really, really not enjoyable. Like there's a lot of moments where I actually was thinking like, why the hell do I do this one day? I was thinking, because there are a lot of moments where like, okay, I would prefer to quit right now, or this hurts. And I think that's, you know, comparable to running a business. I'm not in that advice suggesting that only do stuff you find fun. It's not at all what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that how you relate to it, say building Vox, should be less about whether, you know, ultimately it is as externally successful or not, but whether you think you built something great or not.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be a lot of pain along the way, but at the end of the day, if you have built something great, and I think you have built something great. So, I mean, I think you've already won.
I appreciate that. That's very kind of you.
You see what I mean? I think you have won. And I think that's the way to think about life. I think that's very good advice. Is like this, another way you could say, like, what game are you trying to play?
Right.
And be careful you think about, you know, are you trying to build, let's say with Vox, are you trying to build the cable news network? Well, maybe you wouldn't necessarily feel so great about that, even if you did, CNN, I mean. I don't know, maybe you would. I think being very careful about what game you're trying to play is really important, and doing things you feel proud of. That's very different advice than, oh, you know, do whatever you love. It means doing a lot of things you hate, actually, or find terrible, but where you think that it is a worthy end in itself. I mean, maybe this all comes back to sort of almost banal advice as to take action that you feel is motivated authentically by what you think is right or you want to accomplish in life. That's getting more into it. Anyway, I try to do that. Obviously, it's hard to keep to that 100%, but that's that advice.
That is good advice. All right. And then the last question, what are three books that have influenced you that you would recommend to the audience?
Strongly influenced at early stage in my life by the writings of Franz Kafka. Maybe that's where you get this dark sediment. Okay, I'm going to just choose three novelists who, if people haven't read, I feel that they should. If they like my books, they maybe will enjoy these novelists. So Wallace Stegner's Crossing to Safety, for some reason that book has just stuck with me for a long time, maybe as about a way life can be. I said earlier, I've always been drawn to the work of Franz Kafka. Maybe explain some of the darkness in some of my books. The Trial was to me the most mesmerizing and oddly hilarious book maybe I ever read. And I'm a big fan of Ishiguro and The Remains of the Day. If you haven't read it, it does dwell on some of these themes we were just talking about as to what makes for a worthwhile life, whether the means or the end are important. In fact, it challenges some of what I was saying earlier. So those are three books that come to mind.
Remains of the Day is right fantastic. Such a beautiful book. Have you read his newer one, which is a fantasy? It's a take on fantasy book, but is also about memory and belonging.
Oh, yes. The Giant, The Buried Giant.
The Buried Giant, yeah. That was my favorite book of 2014, 2015. Yeah, the whole set.
I'm such an Ishiguro fanatic that everything he writes, I read.
Yeah.
I think he's not without his limitations, but he has a certain powerful magic. And even his books, the ones that are like imitations of Kafka set in Prague, I read those also. I've read every word he's written, I believe. And I don't know what it is, but it's like, you know, his wavelengths coincide with mine. And yeah, so Ishiguro, I don't know if he's a guide or something, but yeah, I think if you, some people just, it doesn't work for them, and I understand it, but if it works for you, he's getting at stuff that is really, really deep.
Tim Wu, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. And it's been a pleasure, as they say. And I hope to see you again one of these days in the
flesh. Yeah, I'd love to see you soon. Let me know if you're in DC anytime. Thank you to Tim. I thought that was great. I hope you all did too. Thank you to my producer, AC Valdez. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox.com and Panoply production, and we'll be back next week.